Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soci.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soci. This show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, we got through another week. Hope you're staying safe. Hope you're staying healthy. Hope you're staying sane. Hope you're being good to one another. And hopefully you got your shots. And we'll get to that in a moment. And hopefully you've been watching some good films, ones that are new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. And we will get to the grab a pencil portion of the show in a little bit. But friends, got a special guest on the line. Life chapters come and go, but friendships remain strong no matter what. And I'm so happy to get this man back on the airwaves in one way, shape, or form. One of the usual suspects. He is in the Film Sociology group picture when it comes to regular guests. He's in it, but he's in the back row because he's tall. Tracy Forner is here. What's happening, buddy?
I appreciate the usual suspects reference.
I think we can still use that.
Well, let's put it on that list of my ever-increasing list of remote-dropping movies like, oh, really? This is on?
Yeah, I have that written down. I think we called your imaginary segment, Oh, Damn, Name of Film is On.
Oh, my. And that's one of the movies that's on the list of movies I've seen dozens of times that doesn't have a horse in it. Because usually, movies that I've seen dozens and dozens of times, well, they usually have a gun.
Okay.
But they also usually have a horse in them at some point. And this, I don't know. I don't think there's one in Usual Suspects.
There is not, but it's funny you mentioned horse, and I immediately went to non-Western titles. Like, so you're watching Secretariat, but that's mostly for Diane Lane.
Well, yeah.
Equus? Are you watching Equus a lot?
No, I'm not watching. I realize we're coming out of this pandemic, but I am still in that mode of I'm not spending a lot of time discovering new things. I want cinematic comfort.
That's all right. That's okay.
Like my wife has just started traveling again for business, and she's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm watching Lethal Weapon. She's like, you've seen Lethal Weapon 300 times. I'm like, yeah. She's like, why aren't you watching a movie that your lips don't move to the dialogue? I'm like, because it's very comforting right now.
So,
and it's before Gary Busey went completely crazy. So, you know, I don't begrudge anybody what they're watching right now for any reason. But, you know, you want to go Brain Candy, you want to go Kids in the Hall, like with that movie. But I'm like, yeah, no, whatever. You need to check out and just watch something that's like your best friend cinematically. I'm all in.
Okay. So, all right. Now that you brought it, what was the last film your lovely wife made you sit down and watch that was new to you?
Whew. Okay. Okay. New to me?
Sure.
You're going to hang up on me.
No, I won't.
I'd never seen it. Proof of Life.
All right. It
like
happens.
Like a week and a half ago, I'm like, what are you doing? I'm like, I see Russell Crowe on screen, and my wife's watching. I'm going, all right, I get it. I get it. I know where I rank. And Proof of Life was on, and I had never actually seen it. And so we watched it, and it was like, you know. And then, of course, cable companies being who they are and what they are, they immediately followed that up with L.A. Confidential. So... Nothing on the...
You were stuck.
Yeah. nothing on the husband to-do list got done because I'm like, yeah, I'm going to watch that. I want to watch Exley and Bud White and Dudley and all that stuff go down and Hush Hush and on the QT. So it was like, it was curious to me. I was watching a movie that old, you know, air quotes old, that I had never seen with a Meg Ryan, you know, and a Russell Crowe. And I was like, wow, I can't believe. And Morse, that guy.
Yep, David Morse. Yep.
He's a that guy.
Oh, Hall of Fame, that guy.
Yeah, like St. Elsewhere, that guy.
Yep. Exactly. In fact, I just revisited 12 Monkeys, and I forgot that he was in that Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys, which is now available on Arrow Home Video or Blu-ray. I just revisited. But, yeah, he's a major plot point in that, and it's quite good.
And he's one of those guys that's like, he's not, like he's not Hollywood physically big. He's Midwestern physically big. And I don't think people appreciate that. Like I think he's my size, and
wow.
I am not a small person.
No, you're not. I think there's a basketball, like one of his early films. He plays. There's a basketball scene in. I think it's Inside Moves.
Yeah, oh man, you gotta.
You're gonna look for it now.
I gotta rake some moss and dust off that memory, but no, I think you're right. Yeah.
So you mentioned your lovely wife and Russell Crowe. Is she also on Team Russell in the Unhinged years?
We haven't seen that, but she's referenced that in our personal life with my penchant for screaming at speeders in our neighborhood. And that I now, in my advanced years, I have the first truck in my life ever.
Uh-huh.
In the last year, I have a truck. And I have a tendency to yell at speeders. And it's like, whatever. Old man Forner. Whatever. And by the way, you don't have to stay off my lawn. I don't care about my lawn. I just want you to not drive fast past my lawn.
Of course.
And then when this movie came out, and I talked to the director a long time ago about it, and I was so happy that this was a Zoom call in a Zoom mode.
Yeah.
Where I said, you know, people had talked about comparing it to other movies, and I had said to him that it was, to me, it was like Jaws, and his eyes lit up a little bit because I'll take any movie back to Jaws.
Yes.
And he's like, oh yeah, that's it. But then my wife was like, yeah, you can't do that. You don't realize anymore that you think you're doing a service to the neighborhood. So basically, I'm not allowed to go after speeders anymore.
You say the neighborhood vigilante.
Sort of.
Well, I will say when you get to get around to it, you also have to throw Duel into the mix because,
yes.
The weapon's a truck.
I saw Duel. There was a short period of time in my at my parents' house where I was having trouble sleeping, and my mother's remedy was to put a TV in there.
Or say, no, it was Duel.
And it was back when there's like, you know, when cable was three channels. I saw Duel in black and white, and it was Jaws. It was like, it scared the heck. Dennis Weaver, are you kidding me? It was, to me, Duel was Jaws meets Jeepers Creepers, which
that's
I realize
pretty good.
Is like a bit of a...
No, that's a good pitch.
It's, you know, like you don't quite know what the bad thing is, but anyway.
No, it's funny. I'm going to also pick up this name that I just dropped. Dennis Weaver visited Ball State when I was a senior and did an acting workshop and a few other things, and he bragged about being the only actor whose name was above Spielberg's in the title. Because it was his first TV. It was a TV film that later made it into the theaters, so... Hey, speaking of family stuff, Tracy, I want to say congratulations on your retirement from the sandwich-making industry.
Oh, my God. Well, actually, my retirement from that came well before the end of the school year.
Okay.
My boys, God love them. My oldest son graduated from high school. It's this weekend. My youngest son just turned 14. They are the two oldest young men you've ever met in your life. like they should be stunt doubles in a remake of the Sunshine Boys. Like they just sit on park benches with their legs crossed. They should be like keeping conversations with Norman Lear. They're just old souls.
Socks with sandals.
Yeah. Like really scrunchy hats. Like a Colonel Blake hat. It should have a bunch of lures.
Yes. Yeah.
That sort of thing. They've been to their credit, they've been making their lunches for a while, but the fact that some of the school schedules are, oh my God, the four-way stop in front of the school is just
that's where you want to be unhinged.
Oh my, yeah, I'm close. That's where I say to my youngest, you know, you heard that, but just because you heard that doesn't mean you get to say it. And he's like, yeah, I understand. So, yeah, we're hitting a bunch of milestones. Daughter, you have an incredibly creative daughter. I know that.
Thank you.
My daughter is graduating from Heron School of Art at IUPUI this summer. And my son's graduating from high school in Brownsburg here this next weekend. And then the youngest is going to high school. So,
oh, geez.
We ain't empty nesting, but I'm not feeling spry either.
It's a big chapter. It's funny. I help out with a pre-K. And, well, that's another story for another time. But I see them because there's moments like, you know, when I get to throw a plastic ball to a 3 or 4 year old with a wiffle ball bat. And I say, well, I never had a son. And there are also times when I try to get up and get down from sitting or laying on the floor going, this is more like a grandfather than a son, you know, than a father thing. So,
noises.
Yeah.
You make noises. You don't realize you're making noises.
Yes, exactly. And then I, you know, meet the parents and went, oh, you could have gone to school with my, well, not quite that bad, but you get the idea. The age range. So speaking of the kids, what has the movie habits been? Have you been able to sit down with them and watch stuff, or are they just going into their own universes and screens?
No, I try to make it a point, and we revisit some things, and I appreciate some of their, what their, and, you know, you want to equate to the pandemic, that's fine. Certain comfort things in terms of watching. We watched Mitchells.
Yep.
We watched that. That was, full disclosure, my older boy is 19, and he is on the autism spectrum. That was a little frenetic for him.
Sure.
Which
sure.
I get.
Yep.
But that was the first viewing. The 14-year-old was like, oh, my God, this was amazing. So we'll watch it again, and in my older son's mind, it will slow down a bit. The things we go back to that I love, we were downtown, and it was all five of us, which was rare because my wife was traveling at the time. Mm-hmm. And a movie the whole family goes back to often is Isle of Dogs.
Hey, all right.
They love it. The quiet tone. The quiet pace, the lovingness of the relationships and how they grow, and my youngest son's willingness to quote Jeff Goldblum, you know, dogs talk, I listen, I love that sort of thing. They love that. Fantastic Mr. Fox. Another one which I thought they would hate that they go back to, and that's when we all sit down and get quiet, is Kubo.
Oh, and the Two Strings, yes.
And that's like, and again, for my older son who doesn't like frenetic things and emotionally traumatic scenes, like he's okay with it. Just something about it is, the McConaughey casting, I don't get, but that's me.
Yeah, yep.
But they just, so yeah, we get, and then they like stop motion stuff.
Okay.
And I appreciate, you know, and like, again, my daughter's art school student, so we can all sit there and watch it and, like, sort of simmer down. And you know, we do the usual frantic stuff. We got all the Disney, all the Pixar.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can't all decide what to watch, we will pull up the Pixar shorts.
Oh, yeah.
We can watch John Henry on a loop.
There you go.
On a loop. And they like the, for lack of a better, the rustic animation of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when I pull them into the old Jungle Book where it's not so, you know, the animation isn't so slick and smooth. And so
You feel like it's like you hear them with a new song, and you are the one that recognizes the sample for which it came from.
Oh, dude.
Yeah.
The amount of times I've had to explain that Blitzkrieg Bop is not originally from Jimmy Neutron.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. There is that.
And so I appreciate, I don't know if they do it because it's appropriate or if they do it because the licensing is inexpensive. Mr. Blue Sky is in like 7 animated movies. And I have to explain to my kids, you don't have any idea how old this guy is?
There are moments with Emma, like as a family, we're watching Barry. And she, that was her pick, and I'm thoroughly enjoying that. And we still go back to Northern Exposure as a trio.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, and physical copies, friends. And there are certain things, but she will still lean to me, and I will explain what a joke is. Or, like, I'm watching season 5 of Laugh-In, and she'll come in, and I'll have to explain what that meant. So at least there's a little point of reference on that. But yeah, there's also we went through that phase as well. She will recognize a song from something else, and then I'll go, yeah, but I played it on my show or yeah, something to that. Well, yeah. Yeah, something to that ilk. But
I had that on a cassette.
Right. Now, I have to ask, because we actually experienced it last year, and since he was in the news recently, have you shared your family Midnight Run?
I have not yet.
Okay. All right. Sky Point to Charles Grodin, king of deadpan. And I forgot from his interviews where he's so good, you can't tell if he's kidding or not. That's a special skill.
He's so rare. I think he's in a walk-in category where if you're casting a movie, you're like, we need a Grodin. Like, no, get Grodin.
Right.
Like, who else is in that? Like, I was actually having a Twitter exchange today with someone who was watching So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the one scene.
And Grodin's in it, and he's refusing to let his car be commandeered. And he's just being Grodin. But then I was thinking, Alan Arkin is in that dry level of... they're in their own categories, I guess,
mm-hmm.
in that regard. But it was just like, you know, I haven't, but Midnight Run is like, oh my, you don't, it's one of those movies where you got to be, I would have to be quiet about pushing it on my children because I would over push it.
Oh yeah, I've over pushed many a title to my daughter.
And they wouldn't, like, well, yep. Dad, you totally, bringing it back full circle, if I may, I yeah. remember... shoving, back to the introduction, I remember shoving Usual Suspects down my father's throat to the level that after he watched, he's like, yeah, that was pretty good. I'm like, pretty good?
Yep. Yeah.
Guys, you're so sick. Pretty good. And I'm like, that's when I learned, like, you just sort of introduce it and nudge it, and if they take it, great. If not.
Yep. Yeah, that might be another show, is the overshoves, the overshove film festival. Because I've done that. I remember when Emma was really, really getting into Hamilton, and I had to, as a parent, I had to warn her. I was like, honey, I got to listen to something else because I want to like this, and this isn't help.
Yeah,
and then on the flip side, like last year for Father's Day, I said, I want to make a big bowl of pasta and watch The Godfather. And she fell asleep 20 minutes into it.
Oh, The Godfather is a whole... You and I have, like, contemporaries. Like, age-wise, we have contemporaries who just don't get it. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. It's hard. It's hard. What was it? You think that they like something and you latch onto it a little bit. Like, I found out my darling daughter would not mind going into a time machine for 1987 Kevin Costner because of Bull Durham.
Well,
or
88. I don't have a problem. I have a thing with Costner, and I have a lot of people in my life who think I have a problem with Costner.
Uh-huh.
Because I know people, well, you and I know other radio people in this town.
Yes.
Who are like, oh, he's always Costner. And people say that about Nicholson. I will defend Waterworld to the death.
Okay.
Because of what it should have been.
You mean the Road Warrior on water?
No, actually, technically, I would argue. Well, yes, the Road Warrior meets the Postman.
Oh, jeez. Yes. Yeah, the Postman.
He's just an aquatic USPS, whatever.
Yes.
And I'm like, and people are like, how can you do it? I'm like, well, it should have been so much. And they're like, should have been. They spent $250 million and they couldn't make it that. And I'm like, I don't care. I love it. It's over the top.
That's fine. Absolutely. We all have those. You're talking to Mr. Blaxploitation guy, so.
Oh, I know you with your Blaxploitation. It's like you embrace it. You enjoy the badness of certain things.
Yeah. And I showed, like, right after, a few days after Bull Durham, I made the Smarter Two-Thirds sit down, and Lynn, like, sort of saw it, but Emma had never seen it. But we watched The Untouchables, and it was not my daughter's cup of tea. Lynn was okay with it, and, yeah, I'm still enthralled with it. And
I did. Man,
it's a guy film. I guess it's for lack of it's really a guy film because really for my I'm sure for my Smarter Two-Thirds, I'm like, there's two scenes with Patricia Clarkson and that's it.
But the beauty of it, you want to go to the ward? You know, talk about the wardrobe. The wardrobe.
Oh, it looks great.
My best friend in high school's parents owned a convenience store in my small town back when. Everybody, anybody that could rented VHS tapes.
Yes.
Anybody that could. And they had a 7-foot by 3-foot Untouchables banner.
Did you grab it?
Mikey's mom owned the store.
Mm-hmm.
Mikey's mom let me have it.
Ooh.
And I hung that thing forever to no benefit. What is that thing doing in my bedroom? But it was just, it was a gorgeous movie and... I'm sorry, the scene with the baby stroller and the stairs.
Oh, yeah, that's pure De Palma, absolutely.
It's one of those things where it's like, all right, does the whole thing start to finish? Is it amazing? Maybe not. But there's enough classic things. And you got them? Yeah, I got them.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Everybody, I've said this many times on many different platforms, but I yearn for Andy Garcia's confidence. George Stone in The Untouchables.
Yeah, I got him.
It's just like, wow.
When he goes at it with, I like him.
With Connery, yeah.
With Connery. And I know that was a make-good for Connery's entire career. I'm fine with that.
Speaking about, have you seen Fandango?
I have not.
That's okay. I have a wish list for Criterion.
Okay.
Because this is the first collaboration between Kevin Reynolds and Kevin Costner.
Mm-hmm.
This was a year before Silverado. It was after The Big Chill, where Costner got famous for
Yeah, but you saw his hair.
Yeah, you saw his hair. But this was, I believe, Reynolds was the first protege of Spielberg's. It was released through Amblin. At the time, the big name star was Judd Nelson. He had already done Making the Grade. He had not done the Hughes films had not come out yet.
Okay.
1971, Austin, Texas. Guys have graduated, and it's the weekend before they have to report for the draft. And it looks like, if you look at the posters and the ad campaign, it looks like horny college guy film, but it's much more than that. It is a wonderful road trip picture.
Like a Porky's Redux or
something? Oh, much, much more than that. Much more hard. You have a young Susie Amos, a young Glenn Headley in it.
Oh, wow.
Great soundtrack. Sam Bottoms is in it, and it's shot in the desert. And it's for guy road trips. It's Fandango and Sideways.
Here's a future subject for you.
Yes, sir.
I would call it the Tarantino treatment.
Uh huh.
What he did for Travolta.
Yes.
What he should have done for Don Johnson.
We're still waiting on DJ. I know. Yep.
I'm are you kidding me? I will defend Don Johnson.
Absolutely.
I think Judd Nelson deserves a Tarantino treatment. He deserves a redux.
Ooh, good one.
He just suffered from a change in tastes and a change in life where he was.
Yep.
people have had, other people have had incredibly, you know, the Phoenix-like.
But he's still one of those working guys. I mean, I can't remember the last thing I've seen Nelson do, but he's constantly working. And there's a part of it of, so long as the check's clear and you're working, there's something to be said about that.
I distinctly remember an interview I listened to with Pierce Brosnan talking about he post Bond, he considers himself I'm a journeyman actor.
Yep.
I will show me the part. You want me for the part? I'll be there on time every day, and I will do it. And I'm like, I've always appreciated that, despite where his Bond films may fall, whatever, but there's always a soft spot in The Matador for me and my wife.
So. Oh, absolutely. I also enjoyed The Matador and The Foreigner he did with Jackie Chan.
Oh, yeah.
And I have come full circle. I made fun of his vocals, and then I auditioned for a musical. And, you know, it takes serious stones to sing like that and have it captured forever on film, and he got to do it twice. So nothing wrong with that.
Wasn't the argument that they weren't supposed to be singers? Well, they were supposed to be how you would sing in that situation, regardless of what your voice was?
Yeah, so this is Everyone Says I Love You. It's Kenneth Branagh's Love's Labor's Lost. It's La La Land. It's that. It's, you know, that there was that. But it also helped. Maybe it does or doesn't help. It's also celebrity okey, and it's also a jukebox musical. So... I think young people, and by the way, join me on the front porch, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, they didn't cast singers who could act. They asked, you know, they cast actors who were names and like, okay, well, give them a bucket to carry the tune. I'm looking at you, Mame, and Paint Your Wagon, among others. You have a musical with Clint Eastwood and Lee Marvin. They should be, that should have been the Delta Force in 1969.
The first, I was in the seventh grade, and there was a holiday, like, we're not learning anything. We got a day left till holiday break.
Yes.
Seventh grade, they haul us into the cafetorium. Remember the cafetorium?
The cafetoranasium.
Exactly.
Multi-purpose, crappy acoustics. Oh, yeah.
And that's where I saw Cat Ballou.
Wow.
Fell in love with it.
Mine was junior year of high school, history teacher, final week. So Monday through Friday, we watched Gone with the Wind.
Oh, my good Lord.
And it took just about that much time.
Yeah. I'll eat it up.
Oh, my gosh.
Quickly,
go ahead.
So when's the last time you were in a theater?
Oh, God. So here, I need to correct this. And I'm not, it's funny because the IFJA, the Indiana Film Journalists Association, they've already attended some screenings. They've also attended some press-only screenings, which will be my first step. But the last, and I need to correct it, because the last film I saw in the theater was Bad Boys for Life.
Well,
I didn't ask for that.
Your choice.
Martin and Will asked for it. I didn't ask for it. What about you?
I'm trying to remember. it's been a minute.
Uh-huh.
Oh, gosh, I think we saw Dr. Dolittle as a family.
Wait a minute, Dr. Dolittle or Dolittle, Robert Downey Jr.?
Yeah, Dolittle.
Oh, my gosh.
Appropriately
Okay, I don't feel so bad now.
No, it was, but I wanted to, because of what's, I want to bring it back if I can.
Sure.
To my daughter and so Quiet Place is out.
Yes.
I met when the first one came out, I told my daughter, meet me at this, at the Regal in Avon.
Yep.
For, like I said, I can get out of work in time when I had a job. And I said, you could meet me there. We're going to hit this matinee, middle of the week.
Mm-hmm.
We walk in. We think we've got the wrong time. There's no one in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie starts. And no one's coming in. And I look at her, and I say, okay. I said, put your keys on the ground. I'm going to put my keys on the ground. We are not getting concessions. This is it. My daughter and I watched Quiet Place in a theater, and no one else was in it, and no one else showed up.
Wow.
And after 10 minutes, she reached over and she grabbed my hand. She's 20 years old. I'm in a suit and a tie. And we will never have that moment again.
Yep.
I told her, I said, yeah, we're never going to get to see the sequel like that again. But it was so, I mean, it was so not a horror movie to me.
Right.
It was a lot of compelling things. But like knowing that that's coming out this weekend, I told her, I'm like, we're never going to be able to duplicate that.
Yep.
And I've said, there are, that's a top five. There's a scene in that movie, if, for people who haven't seen it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a top five all-time father scene in that movie.
Yes.
What he does.
Yep.
Without giving it away.
Yep.
Is a top five all-time. Now, I would argue with Christopher Lloyd from the film app. I think there's a top five dad moment in Armageddon, but he doesn't want to talk to me about Armageddon.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you over the Aerosmith power ballad.
Yeah. Well, you know, you hire my daughter, and then you got to, that's the deal. It's a combination. But no, that was, I will never have a cinematic experience like that again. It was, but I got to share it with my daughter. It was amazing. It was compelling. It was, we just.
Outstanding.
It was amazing.
So the three that come to mind for me, I'll try to make it quick, was I got to attend the press screening of Skyfall, and then once it opened, taking my smarter two-thirds and then watching my daughter watch Skyfall. Because she was really in the Bond at that time.
Was she in Daniel Craig as Bond, or just Bond in general?
She had gone through the Connerys, I think. Okay. one or two more, and then this was the first Bond she saw in the theater.
Okay.
So that worked.
You and I could do like 47 hours on Bond.
Someday we will. Then we went to the IMAX. We had already seen it opening weekend of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And then they showed it at IMAX, and I had to genuinely use the restroom. And so I go down, and when I come back, it is one of my daughter's favorite moments. It's Brad Pitt on the roof fixing the antenna. And, of course, he removes his shirt. I stayed on the aisle waiting for that moment to happen so she could have that scene by herself.
Sure.
I see her smile curl up on her face because we now call the film Attack of the 70-Foot Brad Pitt. And I wait for the scene to be over, and I, you know, because there's no split in the aisle. You got to go all the way across.
Oh, sure.
And I sit down, and as soon as I sit down, she leaned over and went, I know you did that. Thank you.
This is embarrassing. I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, well, you'll see it when you get to it. And then, actually, a couple days ago, I'd just gotten home. I had to do a couple of calls. And I sit down, and she is at the very end of The Iron Giant.
Oh,
and there are two animated films that we both started sniffing at the same time, The Illusionist
and that.
Yeah. Every time. It's
Iron Giant every time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and it's, you know, I know he has nine of those films out. Oh, by the way, did you know Dom has a brother, apparently, in the Fast and the Furious series, who's never been mentioned in the first eight? Anyway, but yeah, Vin Diesel,
Vin Diesel can do every F and F for the rest of his life because
he's
the giant.
Yeah, Iron Giant, no, and Groot.
And
Find Me Guilty, which nobody sees. An excellent courtroom drama from Sidney Lumet. Speaking of weeping, because we are strong men, we are dads here at Film Sociology.
I'm two things. You don't realize this. I'm the sweatiest person you know. And
thus the suit.
I am the easiest crier you know. So basically, I leak constantly.
Okay. Well, I'm talking about this on the show this week because of a video I recently watched. Give me a Tracy Forner example, a film that has its major flaws, but you still weep.
Oh, man.
I will give an example of one that happened to me in college. This happened to me in college. Lorenzo's Oil. with Susan Sarandon and Nick Nolte, and they have a son who is dying. And George Miller directed it for you Road Warrior fans out there. This came out, I think, a year after my mother had died. It was the first film that I think I saw that involved somebody, especially a child.
Sure.
And they use Adagio for strings, and you see Nick Nolte weeping uncontrollably. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, obviously it hit all of the feels. But that film ends like an infomercial for the oil that saves the sun. And it really left, left a bad taste in my mouth, and it bummed me out. So still like the film, still hits hard, but kind of a popcorn belch at the end.
Yeah. I like a lot of bad movies.
Which is why you're here, among other things.
I am easily forgivable. I grew up with an older brother who, within 10 minutes of sitting in a theater, knew who killed somebody.
Oh,
and it was nice enough not to say anything, but I know, like, I don't look at movies that way. I do this, Christopher Lloyd from the Film Yacht. He's always like, that was so easily. I'm like, was it? I didn't see it coming at all, because I'm going to quote William Hurt from The Big Chill. Sometimes you have to let art just wash over you.
I think
whether
it's
bad art or not.
I think the guy in the hat did something wrong.
You're so analytical.
What are you doing, like, now?
I don't know if I can come up with something that's like, oh, like, plot-wise is unforgivable. Well, I can go back to Waterworld. If you want.
You weep over Waterworld?
I like, no, not weep. Well, okay. I don't know.
Okay, all right.
No, not weep. I am such, man, no, I cry over, okay, I'm old enough, I saw Rocky in a theater.
So did I. Oh, yeah.
I saw Rocky in a theater. I've seen it, no, I've seen Jaws more. But if I'm standing in my kitchen and Rocky's on, I am...
You're there.
I am cheering, and I am like, oh, my God. I'm like, really? This movie's how old? And I think there's going to be a different outcome, and I'm bouncing up and down. So I can't say, like, there's a bad movie.
Okay. No, that's fine.
Give me a minute.
No, it's funny. I was also thinking of animated stuff that Emma and I have both sniffed at, and I forgot, of course, the opening of Up.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Big,
man,
and it's funny because that's, and then I remember the little hipster, as I used to call her, first half is great, and with the house and the balloons, it's great, and then once they land.
Yep.
Then it becomes just a chase movie, and she wasn't particularly crazy about that. Hard to top the first 10 minutes of Up when it comes to
the montage.
Yes,
it's my daughter's old enough now. I mean, she's like, does Pixar have a subdivision that's like, hi, this is, oh, you want to walk into this conference room? This is where they're going to pull your heart out. So they have you for the rest of. I distinctly remember a former coworker posting on Twitter when Inside Out came out.
We need to talk about Bing Bong.
Exactly. That's exactly. It's like.
Yep.
It was like blankety blank Bing Bong, and I'm like, shh.
thank you for covering that.
Yeah, but it was like, oh my God, it's like, you got to do that. and this goes back to Bambi.
Oh, gosh, yeah, yeah.
We need to destroy you first, emotionally, and then, like, they're doing this with 20-foot oak conference tables. Maybe not anymore. Maybe a Zoom. But it's like, and I get it, and I'm all in for all that stuff. The worst Disney movies get me every time.
Okay.
You can't, ugh. I'm a wuss. I'm a dad. I got three kids. I am the sweatiest person you know. But I cry more quickly than I sweat.
Okay, that's no, same here. Same here. Well,
my pores, I have very healthy pores.
Of course, yes, you do. That's why you, that you were fit for television. So that's good. No, absolutely. I've told Emma, and actually, this was great. I got to actually share the story with the source himself. There is a podcast called Cocktails with Dee Dee,
okay,
by Dee Dee Sorvino, the current wife of Paul Sorvino.
Oh,
yes. Yeah. It's a Zoom podcast happy hour thing. You can check for it on Spotify. And I become one of their irregulars. Mm-hmm. First off, I flubbed a line from Goodfellas with Paul on the call.
Mm.
Yeah. Didn't sell it as well as Dustin Hoffman.
Did it have anything to do with shaving?
No. It was Paulie. Paulie doesn't move fast. That's because Paulie never moved fast for anybody. And okay. I'm no Ray Liotta.
He's got to be forgiving.
Well, he was very, very happy. He was very, very.
Put that on my tombstone. I'm no Ray Liotta.
Yeah, but then I was asked to quote The Rocketeer, and I said I'm not going to quote the Rock. I'm not going to quote a man's lines who's right here on the source.
Oh yeah.
But anyway, we were on for St. Patrick's Day, and right before because he will come and go from the show whenever he wants, because he's Paul. But I got to ask, I asked him to do Oh Danny Boy, and he did.
Ooh, wow.
But the big one was, it was the Academy Awards time, and I told my daughter a long time ago, she has heard about the clip, but has never seen it. But when Mira Sorvino won for Best Supporting Actress,
mm-hmm.
and she thanked her dad, and they cut to him, and he is a dad mess.
Yep.
And I said, that's me.
Yep.
Every time you do something amazing. So that's all there is to it.
And we got to stop being apologetic for it. It's
right. It's just, that's us.
Exactly. My son, my older son, he sings, I'm trying to think what he's into lately. Trolls, the movies.
Oh, really? Okay.
He loves the soundtrack.
Sure.
Not about the movies, the soundtrack. When he sings True Colors.
Oh, gosh.
It's.
Ooh.
I'm losing it right now.
Yep. Yep. Oh, man. Oh.
It's pure.
Yep. Oh, my gosh.
It's. Now, I will get out of my truck and go unhinged on somebody at a four-way stop in front of the middle school. But if my son's singing True Colors, I'll second guess it. It's just.
Yep. It's our kryptonite.
Man, it is. People, it's a broad swing.
Hey, I said a long, long time ago, and my wife has picked up on it, and we've actually used it in other things, where every person is one half of two characters from the 100 Acre Wood. And I've always said I was the most unhealthy, which is Tigger and Eeyore. Yeah, you gotta find some gray area in between there, because that's two real extremes, and that's kind of Inside Out. It's kind of your Amy Poehler or your sad Velma. So,
exactly.
I want to throw a title at you because we had mentioned earlier about Charles Grodin, and
yeah.
I had forgotten. Well, I had this film and I hadn't seen it in a long time, but it's really not a Grodin film. He just happens to be in it. But if, and you can use this when we go to cocktail parties, and you can correct people in pop culture, the original quote unquote faux documentary is not Spinal Tap, although as much as we love Spinal Tap,
right.
It's Albert Brooks's Real Life.
Oh.
And,
man, that's been a minute.
I found it. I'm basically, if you know my physical copies of movies and films, I'm going to turn into Michael Caine from City of Children of Men eventually. But Albert Brooks as the filmmaker who's making a documentary about an American family, I think it was like 6 years after PBS really did it. And he is the. You can thank/blame Brooks for the prototype documentary filmmaker who is the star of his own documentary.
Yeah, that's I don't think that guy gets enough credit for a lot of stuff. He's penetrated pop culture in a lot of ways. I'm sorry, just in the for my kids, it's the Simpsons movie.
Oh yeah, and more than Nemo.
He's the one that gives the president the five options.
Yep, yep,
that sort of thing.
It's funny because I think, you know, the opening scene of Finding Nemo's no picnic either, and I think.
Oh my! Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, guess what? Here, hi. Someone's gotta die.
Yeah.
Toss a beer. I know you gotta go. I gotta say this.
Okay.
I firmly believe you are one of the reasons I got my first job in Indianapolis.
Oh, man.
Just be quiet. I know you're
okay, all right. All right.
I'm sitting in a news director's office at Fox 59 when Fox 59 was on Meridian Street, and
yep.
I'm being interviewed by the news director, and we're watching the morning newscast, and the team is talking about the best football movies of all time. And you're there.
Yep.
And the people on the show, on the newscast, are mentioning movies.
Not even close.
That I don't think are. And I muttered under my breath to the news director. I said, yeah, North Dallas 40. I said, the longest yard, North Dallas 40. And she's like, what? I said, the longest yard, North Dallas 40. She's like, and she looked at me. She's like, okay, whatever. And then the anchors and whatever went through their things. And then you said, North Dallas 40. And the longest yard.
Yep.
And as she looked at me. She's like, what? I go, he's not. I said, he's not on air. He's talking about the best movies. There's nothing new, whatever. And it was like, I'm not saying it clinched the deal, but it's your fault. I'm still in the greater Indianapolis area 17 years later, and we're thrilled to be here.
Well, I know we didn't clinch the deal because I haven't received a 1% finder's fee in those 17. No, I'm kidding.
By the way,
yeah.
The original.
Yes, the original. Yes, Eddie Albert died the day before the remake was released. Of course, he was 99, but...
Oh, my God.
No, I will, and then I will counter with this, and I'm. It's always a pleasure to have Tracy Forner, to have you on the show. But friends, I've known him long enough that I don't even, except for this one case, because it had been a while. But if I want him on the show, all I have to write is Friday, and he will chime in within an hour and let me know either yes or we're going to be in some gorgeous spot in Michigan. Sorry. It's so I'm like Bud Fox going after Gordon Gekko's office for a meeting every time I text you and just write Friday.
And then every once in a while, you nail the elephant.
That's now if I can get in the limo with Perks, that's another story.
And John C. McGinley's right there pumping his arm.
Take that for what it's worth, friends. Tracy, have a great holiday. Thank you for letting us be a part of your weekend festivities.
You too, man. All the best to you and your better two-thirds.
Tracy Forner, always the usual suspect. Always good to have on your side. You're listening to the Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. All right, I want to go through what I was watching this week, and then we'll see what's available streaming and in drive-ins, and then we'll grab a pencil and find out what you've been watching. New on video, or new in theaters this week, or streaming, is an independent film called Drunk Bus. And when I first saw the trailer for this, it looked like a party film. But it is not. It is set in Kent, Ohio in 2006 because you got flip phones, among other things. And as the film says at the very beginning, inspired by real stuff, except they don't use stuff. And it's the story of Michael, played by Charlie Tahan. He is the kid, or the guy, the 20-something, who drives the campus bus at night. So not glamorous. And as the evening goes on, not as fun as it just gets worse as the evening goes on between the drunk, the obnoxious, and sometimes both. But it becomes clockwork for him. He's been doing this a long time. His girlfriend dumped him and moved to New York. He's the guy who graduated, maybe, but stayed on campus waiting for her. And it doesn't help that he's living with another guy who is older than most of the residents on campus. So, and he's finding out through his boss, only who you only see, you only hear up until the very end of the film, voiced by Will Forte. Michael has a chance for full-time employment and just stuck at a dead-end job driving the campus bus. And there's a confrontation with frat bro that leads to the company hiring a bodyguard named Pineapple, played by Pineapple Tangora, who's quite good in this. And he not only leads is security, unofficial security on the bus, but he helps break Michael out of his shell. This is a film, it's kind of, if you're a fan of films like, let's say, My Blue Heaven or My Bodyguard, where you have the down and outer, the underdog, who gets a little boost from outside help. More Bodyguard now that I think of it. But it has that kind of 80s vibe of schlub getting some life lessons from a much more dominant and stronger figure. And a bond, a friendship starts to evolve. And yes, there will be some comeuppance. There's not a whole lot of there's a lot of plot in the film that you can figure out coming a mile away. And I'm happy to say it doesn't turn into a full studio film at the end. It does have an independent film ending to it. And I know that's very vague, but it's I'll say it wraps up in a bow, but not a nice, pretty bow. I'll say that. But yeah, it's a nice chemistry between Charlie Tahan and Pineapple. And there's also, you have the dope dealer who's really into Devo. There is a passenger who's a nurse who winds up having, opens up Michael in certain ways. We also have the backstory of the mentor with a past. There is also a little bit of nice friction, nice chemistry between Michael and a classmate named Kat, played by Kara Hayward, for you fans of Moonrise Kingdom and Us. It's an underdog comedy that wouldn't have made it in 1982. There's a little more nuance to it than those films back in the early days. So, yeah, look for Drunk Bus, worth checking out. Also on IndiePix home video, I mentioned with Tracy earlier, I was trying to bring up the subject of flawed films. But you still wept. And I actually went to Facebook and got some examples. And I'll get to that in a little bit. But first, I want to bring up the Nigerian drama called Last Days, which is apparently inspired by a true story. And then, of course, they advertise it at the end. If you look up the Mama Peace Foundation, a single mom. Well, she's not single at the beginning. She is the breadwinner of the family, alcoholic husband who winds up dying in a bus accident, and she has to raise her two teenage kids and make money and is a woman of faith, and as the film goes on, she develops breast cancer. So there is maintaining work, trying to fight the breast cancer. She's going to one of her bosses for money, even though the boss's wife hates her. And there's a clash between religion and cancer, basically. If you know anybody who has dealt with cancer and you felt that your spirituality has been challenged or thwarted, this is the film for you. And it's a lovely performance from Vivian Metshi, who plays the mother, and has a big old rant about halfway through to God about why is God doing this to her. And anybody who's experienced or had family who has experienced the big C, it's going to hit hard. And it did for me. And so I recommend it. Like I said, it's a hard watch. It's about 2 hours and 20 minutes. They kind of tightened it a little bit. But there are a couple things about the film that kind of turned me off. And not just because at the end, there is a thing called the Mama Peace Foundation. At the end, near the end of the film, the character, the Vivian Metshi, the Mama Peace character, does speak at a women's group about breast cancer awareness, which was big in Nigeria at that time. The fact that this was a small group starting with that. But the boss's wife, who is an absolute one-dimensional shrew through the first half of the film and does too fast of a turnaround for me. We don't see any transition from pure hatred to sympathy. And that's a problem. She loses it when she finds out that her husband has been writing checks so she could get so Mama Peace could get medical treatment. And I don't see the change, and it's just a bit abrupt. And I had mentioned Lorenzo's Oil in the conversation with Tracy, where the end of that film felt like an infomercial. This one does not, but there is mention of the Mama Peace Foundation. It's kind of like when you're watching a biopic or a biopic, and you get to see the actual subject at the end of the film. A number of films have done that. I think of the first time it popped in was What's Love Got to Do with It? Minor quibble, but that's an example of a very powerful film. I wept very hard watching this, but there's still some problems with it that I have. So anyway, but it's still worth checking out, especially for the Vivian Metchie performance. Look for Last Days on IndiePix home video. So I posted on Facebook yesterday as a bonus film sociology question, and I brought it up because of Last Days as well as Lorenzo's Oil. What film have you experienced that has pretty big flaws, but you wept anyway? And I got a handful of answers, so let's go through them. Jared writes Cadillac Records. Yeah, as the host of the show on Saturday night, yeah, there's some... They run loose with some of the timelines and facts on that. So, yeah, but I'm with you, Jared. I do love the end when the musicians wind up in Europe for the first time, even if they got the timeline wrong. So Frank writes Burnt. Jared writes Letters to Juliet. Ah, Franco Nero and Vanessa Redgrave. And they have a new film coming out that Nero is directing with Vanessa Redgrave and... He's hired Kevin Spacey, so there's your movie news this week. Okay, back to the list. Daniel says, losing Isaiah had me bawling at the end. I need to revisit that one. Jessica Lange versus Halle Berry back in the 90s. Matthew writes, A Dog's Purpose. Judy writes, Avengers Infinity War. Scott writes, the final scene from the 1979 version of The Champ. If you don't cry from the scene, something is seriously wrong with you. If you're crying over John Voight and Ricky Schroeder, maybe something is wrong with you. Nah, that was easy. That was an easy dig. Judy writes because of Winn-Dixie. Bethany writes Les Mis. Judy also writes Brian's Song. Yes, Brian's Song and Bang the Drum Slowly, sports films that made it okay for guys to cry. Nancy writes Hashi. It's so bad and I bawled. And I own it on Blu-ray. Kate writes Notting Hill. Abby writes Forrest Gump, Fried Green Tomatoes, and Where the Heart Is. Mike writes Titanic. David writes The Majestic. Wayne writes Up, Avengers Endgame, The Cure, and My Dog Skip. Joe writes Beaches. Leo writes How to Train Your Dragon and Big Hero 6. Kind of the same flaws, actually. Okay, Alan. Anything by Jerry Lewis. And finally, Mason writes Out of Africa. So there you go. Flawed films that still made you weep. That's what we do here at Film Sociology. Some other stuff I got to watch this week. So as I mentioned on last week's program, Arrow Films has reissued 12 Monkeys. And it was fun to revisit Terry Gilliam's time travel saga with Bruce Willis back when he cared. Well, Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt, and Madeline Stowe, of course. Brad Pitt got his first Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor in that film. And it was a film that Willis and Pitt wanted to show that they could act. Let's put it this way. Bruce Willis was already an action star by the time he worked on this. Brad Pitt had already played pretty boys in going back to Thelma and Louise, among others. And both of them are quite good in this. Willis is a little more low-key compared to his action stuff. But no smirking. No smirking in this one from Mr. Willis. But anyway, there is a documentary about the making of the film, which I had not seen before. And this was one that Gilliam let them film from the get-go. Basically, the film had a budget of $29 million, and it couldn't be harder than an R, and it had to be under two hours and 15 minutes. And you get to see some tension between Gilliam and the producers. Gilliam was also injured during the filming of the film, but while the film was being made. So, and also the fact that I was talking to some actors last week after watching this documentary, but there's a famous story that they had a press screening or a test screening of it, and the audience crowd went well, but once they got it to paper, they weren't that strong. And, you know, Terry Gilliam was telling folks he's not making a Bruce Willis movie. And much to Gilliam's credit, he stuck to his guns, did minor changes, nothing major, and it turned out to be one of the most successful films of Gilliam's career. So anyway, it was fun to revisit the commentary track and this documentary I had not seen before, The Hamster Effect, of 12 Monkeys, which is available on Blu-ray from Arrow Films. Also on Arrow Films, friends, there is a 4K transfer, Blu-ray edition of Sergio Corbucci's Django, the original Django with Franco Nero, the second time we brought up Franco Nero on this program, as a lone man who's dragging a coffin across the West, and it's got a giant gun in it, a giant kind of Gatling gun. And like Clint Eastwood in A Fistful of Dollars, he kind of intervenes among two warring factions, in this case, Mexican bandits and some revolutionaries. Corbucci, many have said, is the best of the Sergio Leone knockoffs. And I don't think he ever tried to be Leone. He made spaghetti westerns, but they were cheaper and grubbier and dirtier and a little more grotesque at times. While traditional Westerns, you have a lot of tumbleweeds and dust, in Django, it's mud. And whenever Corbucci could add mud and snow, he would do it. So it helps that you also had Franco Nero and his steely eyes, which kind of like Clint Eastwood. And he winds up shacking up in a saloon/brothel, which is the neutral territory between the two gangs. Yes, there is a mud fight between the women. There's actually a moment where the preacher, who's also turns out to be an informant for one of the gangs, gets his ear cut off, and you see more of that in Django than you do in Reservoir Dogs. So take that. But yeah, Morricone score that sounds like Morricone, because that's what everybody was going for. But yeah, look up the films of Sergio Corbucci. Navajo Joe is another one of note. The Great Silence with Klaus Kinski. Navajo Joe, of course, is with Burt Reynolds, as he described it in a Natalie Wood wig. But yeah, there have been so many video releases of Django, and there is a decent DVD of it from Anchor Bay. This one, it's a step above that, a big step above that. So get your 4K Blu-ray players and enjoy Sergio Corbucci's Django. And I'll get to some of the bonus features, and there's a second feature with it, hopefully on a very future Film Sociology. As I mentioned with Tracy, when it comes to the faux documentaries, because I don't want to say mockumentaries, because I don't want Chris Guest to get angry, but many people point to Spinal Tap as the granddaddy of those. Really, it's Albert Brooks's real life. And the backstory was in the early 70s, PBS did do a documentary about an American family. And this is Albert Brooks's take on that. Charles Grodin is the father of the family that is the subject, that is a veterinarian living in Phoenix, Arizona. And Brooks plays a blown-up version of himself. And as I mentioned with the chat with Tracy, you can thank/blame Brooks for playing the overbearing documentary filmmaker who becomes the star of his own documentary. You can add your favorite documentarian who's in that category as well. You know who they are. And it's not really a Charles Grodin film, although Grodin is in it. It was fun to watch this, and I forgot to the extremes that Brooks goes through. And again, his comedy is not for everybody, and there is a certain Brooks faction, you know, who get his comedy. And so he would later make Modern Romance, which I need to revisit. And of course, Defending Your Life just came out on Criterion, and as well as Lost in America fairly recently. So hoping to get back to those Albert Brooks films. But yeah, did that as a salute to Charles Grodin. Look for Real Life. It's on Paramount. And also from Arrow Films, oh my goodness, a Bill Rabane collection. It's known as Weird Wisconsin, the Bill Rabane Collection. And I will be talking more about this collection as time goes on. But the first one that I experienced is one I had seen before, Monster a Go-Go. If you are a Mystery Science Theater fan, here is a chance to watch one of their better riff films without the riffs. A story of an American astronaut who was lost and then found, was not blind, could not see, but a space capsule with the astronaut, and he has been exposed to radiation and becomes a giant walking zombie with burnt cornflakes on his face. A film that is plagued with radiation, as well as sound drops that just happen in the film, and really bad narration, just some bad sound moments. And also, as I wrote in my notes, are these actors or friends? You know those films. And yes, white teens dancing in a house party, not like my Saturday night show. But it helps that the film is under 70 minutes. Especially without the riffs. But you have, you know, the teen couple making out in the car, and the girl runs away and kills the boy. And, you know, what do we do to take, you know, what is the military going to do to, and of course, it doesn't look like a military compound. It looks like an office or a classroom. So anyway, fun. This was one I had never seen as is, and it's a part of the Bill Rabane collection of Weird Wisconsin, the Bill Rabane collection on Arrow Video, Monster a Go-Go. And we'll be spending more cinematic trips to Wisconsin very, very soon. And we'll get to Laugh-In Season 5 on next week's program, hopefully. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Before we grab a pencil and find out what you've been watching, let's see what's available around the state, whether it's live or virtual, shall we? Over at IU Cinema, they are off until Tuesday, June 1st, you know, holiday weekend, so mark your calendars on these. Tuesday, June 1st through Friday, June 4th, the IU virtual screening of the 1934 musical Zuzu. That is happening over there. On Tuesday the 1st, a special virtual event, new 4K restoration at 7 o'clock, the 1935 comedy musical Princess Tam Tam. It says, join us for a virtual film introduction and film screening with the Black Film Center / Archive. That is Tuesday, June 1st at 7 o'clock. Thursday, June 3rd at 7 p.m., a special virtual event, Happy Birthday, Josephine Baker. Join us for a virtual conversation and interactive Q&A with IU Black Film Center / Archive Director Dr. Terry Francis and author Hanif Abdulariq. I hope I'm saying that right. I'm sorry. That is Thursday, June 3rd at 7 o'clock. Happy Birthday, Josephine Baker. And Tuesday, June 8th at IU Cinema, a special virtual event at 7 p.m., the monthly movie roundup virtual edition. Regular series featured on the IU Cinema's blog, A Place for Film. That is happening over at IU Cinema. Over at the Tibbs Drive-In, on screen 1, Cruella. On screen 2, Raya and the Last Dragon. On screen 2, Spiral. And the second movie, Those Who Wish Me Dead. On screen 3, A Quiet Place Part 2 and Cloverfield. And screen 4, they're doing the Rambo movies. Well, the first 3. So that is happening over at the Tibbs Drive-In. Over at the Skyline Drive-In this weekend, you have Shrek and A Quiet Place Part 2. And then don't forget, on Wednesday, June 23rd, starting at 6 p.m., the John Cassavetes film The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, as well as the film Cutting Class. I am trying to talk my smarter two-thirds, or at least Mrs. Sosi, to attend that with me, because how often do you get to see a John Cassavetes film at a drive-in? It sounds like an Abdul bit of something that he and I would do. Anyway, continuing on marking your calendars, at the Skyline Drive-In on Wednesday, July 28th at 6 p.m. It is Spookies plus the Sorority Babes in the Slime Ball Bowl-A-Rama. So that is... that's over at the Skyline Drive-In at the Historic Art Craft Theater this weekend, Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m. Oh, I'm sorry. The 2 p.m. is on Saturday is still available. Saturday night is sold out. The original Back to the Future is happening at the Art Craft Theater in Franklin. Tuesday, June 1st at 10 a.m. is Despicable Me. Friday and Saturday, June 4th and 5th. At 2 and 7:30 p.m., A Star is Born. This is the 1954 version with Judy Garland and James Mason. And Tuesday, June 8th at 10 a.m. is Hook. All of that is happening at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. Over at the Can-Can Cinema and Brassiere, they already have some on-demand shows, including The Story of a Three-Day Pass, the film by Melvin Van Peebles from 1968. And yeah, this is before Sweet Sweetback, so check that out. As well as Beast, A Glitch in the Matrix, Some Kind of Heaven, Long Year Short Films, Us Kids, and The World of Wong Kar Wai. That is all happening. And there you can also go online, sorry, and check out the 17 Blocks Q&A. That's available on the CanCan Indie website, cancanindie.com/on-demand. All right, friends, grab a pencil. Let's see what you've been watching. Starting on Twitter, oh, the Todd, for, you know, fans of other public radio stations. Hey, the Todd. He wrote, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, a weird yet fun movie. Too bad they weren't available to make Buckaroo Banzai Against the World Crime League as the sequel. It confused people when that came out in 1984, if I remember correctly, and I need to revisit that. I think I was I think I rented it when it first came out and just never returned to it. So I need to get back at that. So thank you, The Todd. Hope things are well on Saturday night. Renee writes on Twitter, Pre-Code Design for Living. So that is happening over there on Twitter. We go to Facebook. And I can't remember if I read this last week or not. If I did, I apologize, but it's my buddy Bill Simmons. Bill writes, I recently watched a double feature of La Strada and Airport 77. I did read this last week. Oh, well, I'm reading it again. There was a strange parallel between the way Anthony Quinn treated Giulietta Messina and Lee Grant treated Christopher Lee. And yeah, because I had just finished the Criterion Fellini box set. So, Bill, that's a fascinating double feature. You should do that at our imaginary art house drive-in. That was good. Austin Glidden, for you fans of Medium Cool Podcast, go check that out. In the 1946 Ingmar Bergman film Crisis, as well as Star Wars A New Hope. And you'll be hearing a conversation with Austin and I on his podcast somewhere down the road. Just saying. Okay, back to Facebook. Joe writes, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and in honor of John Wayne's birthday, Fort Apache, Rio Grande, she wore a yellow ribbon, and then wrote, Have a great day. Here, okay, Joe, thank you for your contribution. I am also chuckling because the first time I saw his post, because there's no punctuation, I read it as The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, in honor of John Wayne's birthday. That is not the case. I read it properly and correctly the first time. Joshua writes, Those Who Wish Me Dead, and Pink, All I Know So Far. David writes, Army of the Dead, Those Who Wish Me Dead, and The Majestic. Adrian writes, Frida. Britt writes, Oxygen, Faults, and Wonder Woman 1984. RJ writes, Land. Cassie writes, Soul, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, Chamber of Secrets, and Prisoner of Azkaban. David writes, Alien and Alien 3. We're just skipping... Aliens. Dave writes, Green Book, great movie. Dylan writes, The Giant Spider Invasion. Eric writes, Midnight Run, in honor of Charles Grodin. Yes, why aren't you popular with the Chicago Police Department? Liza writes, We rewatched The Green Mile, loved it again. More Austin, Killer Clowns from Outer Space, 1988. I had never actually watched it from beginning to end, but there was a guerrilla screening of it here in Lafayette. So technically, this was the first film I've seen outside my house since the pandemic started. A bar called The Spot has a patio with a white brick wall, and this dude does a thing called The Spot Cinema Screenings. He had a laptop, big Bluetooth speaker, projector, and that brick wall. It was fun. And now we've read this. Well, he posted on social media. I just read it on the airwaves. Mary writes, It with Tim Curry. Steven writes, I love Steven. Steven's posts are like entering his home. John's been on a Mitchell Leeson kick. I hope I'm saying that right. We watched Easy Living, Death Takes a Holiday, and No Man of Her Own. Also, sorry to bother you, the first 15 minutes of Let the Sun Shine In and just last night, The Woman Condemned, which really made me crave a rewatching of another totally incomprehensible and much better made noir, The Big Sleep. Thank you, Steven. Thank you, John. Rachel writes, Abbott and Costello in the Foreign Legion and Broken Arrow. I'm assuming this is the old Western and not the John Woo film, Rachel. Just checking. I know you. John writes, The Evil That Men Do. Oh, you should go to the Golan Globus podcast. They may have talked about that. The Last Days, the documentary on Holocaust survivors, and A Bug's Life. Tony writes, Underworld, 1927. Yes, there's not enough Kate Beckinsale in that version. And as Tony writes, there's not enough Kate Beckinsale in her Underworld movies. That is correct, sir. Thank you, Tony. Chris Lloyd writes, Spirit Untamed, A Quiet Place Part 2, Cruella, and Tango Shalom. And, of course, you can go to the Film Yap and check out all of those reviews that Chris just mentioned. Missy writes, Boston Legal. Okay. Melissa writes Quiet Place Part 2 and Cruella. Eric writes The Bourne Supremacy, The Bourne Ultimatum, Lovers Courageous, the Robert Montgomery from 1932, The Blind Side, Salesman, and Midnight Run, which is still a delight. I'm with you on that one, Eric. Jonathan writes The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Nancy writes, We watched Teen Wolf. So many things that wouldn't make it into the film today. Stiles was 28 when it was filmed. Thank you, Nancy. Taylor writes, Zack Snyder's Justice League, the restored version of Touch of Evil, and the Brothers Rico. Lou Harry just writes, The Zombies in Vegas movie. Thank you, Lou. Doug writes, Spellbound, 1945. The Postman Always Rings Twice, the 1946 version. Last Year at Marienbad, 1961. Freud, Lawrence of Arabia, Mutiny on the Bounty, 1962. That Touch of Mink and The Woman in the Window from 2021. I bet you watched Rear Window recently, Doug, because of The Woman in the Window. Kevin writes The Terminal. Dustin writes Pygmalion from 1938, Wuthering Heights from 1939, Hobson's Choice from 1954, and 1966's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which I will be directing in October, and I will shamelessly plug that when it gets a little bit closer. Terry writes Crumbs from 2015, not the documentary about Crumb from the 90s. Don't Look Back from 1967, Unteenth Rewatch, Happy Birthday, Bob Dylan. No Direction Home, Rewatch, and The Hot Rock from 1972. Eric chimes in, No Direction Home is brilliant. Terry chimes in, a great retrospective indeed. Lila writes, Does Halston count? Sure. Mike writes, Chicken Run. Chris writes, Flight. Michelle asks, Do documentaries count? Yes, Michelle, documentaries count. Documentaries always count. They're films. Love your documentaries, please. And now I'm going to reply to her here. Hot typing action here at Film Sociology. Jackie writes Halston. Martin writes Rewatch Some Like It Hot. I need to give a shout out to Martin. He on more than one occasion on the Blues Show, on the Blues House Party, will film himself grilling protein and sharing it with me on the Blues House Party Facebook page. Always love to see great food being made while my show is happening. So thank you, Martin. Paul writes, finally saw The Master. Wonderful performances, and after mulling it over a couple days, I think I know what it was about. Yeah, Paul, if you know the end of The Master, the Paul Thomas Anderson film, it's all about Sam Bress. That's all. I'm kidding. Maybe. Eric writes, I wore my yellow pants and watched Deadpool. Congratulations, Eric. Anthony writes The November Man and gives it a B+. Brent writes the Manchurianian. I'm butchering that. Sorry, Brent. Sorry, Brent. Andrew writes My Fair Lady. Gary writes The Empire Strikes Back, Spider-Man, The Mighty Ducks, It, the 2017 version, Frozen, When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit, and The Big Boss. Daniel writes Murder by Natural Causes, Topper, Tammy and the Bachelor, The Kid Detective, Secrets of the Pirate's Inn, and Blowout. Oh, I love Blowout, Daniel. That's I would like to share that with the Smarter Two Thirds. Quite possibly, if it's not his best performance, one of John Travolta's best performances, and quite possibly my favorite Brian De Palma film. Sorry, fans of Scarface. Tom writes Empire of the Sun and Galaxy of Terror and said it was a weird week. It's all right, Tom. We all have weird weeks. Jesse writes SOB, The In-Laws, I'm assuming that's the original, The Brass Bottle, Touch of Evil, Brain Damage, and Phantasm. Julia writes The Hot Rock, Ladies of the Jury, and Dogfight. Janet writes Darkest Hour, Rollerball, Bombshell, and The Expendables. Wow. I hope you didn't watch Bombshell and The Expendables back-to-back. And I'm assuming it's the original Rollerball, because the less we talk about the remake, the better. Robert Muggy writes seven films directed by Mitchell Lysons, who is so much better than I knew. I've heard about we just talked about this. Death Takes a Holiday, Midnight, Easy Living, Murder at the Vanities, Remember the Night, No Man of Her Own, and Kitty. Thank you, Robert. Joe writes Paycheck with Ben Affleck. Yes, the John Woo film. Craig writes My Fair Lady. Moveen writes Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story. Yeah, I have that on Blu-ray because it came out on Criterion earlier this year, and I need to get on that. Promising Young Woman, and then she writes in parentheses, Don't Mess with Carey Mulligan. The title I keep butchering, The Maturianian, Don't Mess with Jodie Foster, and A Mama Night with Kate Winslet and Saoirse Ronan. I am just butchering titles today, friends. Bob writes Electric Dreams, the almost forgotten debut of Virginia Madsen. I got to talk to her about that. Yes, let me pick up this name I dropped. Michael writes Those Who Wish Me Dead, Tom Clancy's Without Remorse, The One and Only Ivan, The Fellowship of the Ring Extended Edition, which means it's still ending. And Mike Wallace is here. Thank you, Michael. Kathy writes Dead Man with Johnny Depp. I hope you like that, Kathy. That's weird, odd, quote-unquote Western there. Joe writes, Mo Better Blues, Army of the Dead, State of Play, and The Empire Strikes Back. James writes, Journey to the Center of the Earth on import Blu-ray. Congratulations, James. Mason writes, The 39 Steps. Mark writes, All the President's Men. Then All the President's Men with the Robert Redford commentary. Very good, Mark. Michelle writes the original Magnificent Seven. And then Leo writes, A friend loaned me all their Studio Ghibli DVDs. This week I saw Kiki's Delivery Service, A Wind Rises, Whisper of the Heart, and Princess Mononoke, which he has deemed my favorite. Congratulations, Leo. I'm glad you are experiencing those. I just talked to a couple parents with young children about the Ghibli films and the Miyazaki films, and I've always said Ponyo is the best kind of 101 gateway into that world. So, and I have the Blu-ray of these same films, and I'm hoping I can finish these. We can finish these before Emma goes to school. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent Green is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Hope you're staying safe. Hope you're staying healthy. Hope you're staying sane. Hope you're being good to one another. Hope you get your shots if you haven't already. And hope you get to watch some great films that are new or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. And please have a long, relaxing holiday weekend, no matter how you celebrate. Thank you for listening. All right, we're going to end this week's Film Sociology because of the release of Django, Sergio Carbucci's Django on Blu-ray from Arrow Video. Yep, we're going to hear the title track written by Luis Bacalov and also performed with Rocky Roberts on the vocals. Here's Django. Have a great weekend, everyone. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
Oh, you cannot. I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
Parent, are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!